You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Coming up to 7 minutes past 12 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Ray White, in for Stephen Curtis on the Midday Report this afternoon. Well, coming up on the program in the next hour, the ICC is delivering judgment regarding South Africa's failure to hand over Sudanese leader Omar al-Bashir. A crack investigation team is looking into the break-in at the Hawks offices. And the ANC has called for the social grants beneficiary age to be extended from 18 to 21. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree? I'd like to chat to you about these and other stories. Remember, you can SMS on 31702 or 31567 or tweet on @RayWhiteSA. To our top story, and journalists have been called on to wear black or black armbands today in solidarity with the South African National Editors Forum. It's turning to the courts to stop the Black First, Land First movement from harassing or protesting at the homes of journalists. SANF is arguing for an urgent court interdict. The BLF has released a list of journalists it's targeting. These reporters have been concentrating on state capture. We are due to go shortly live to SANF head Matlatsi Gallons. She is in court there at the moment. Stay tuned to the Midday Report. We will be staying with the story to find out exactly what happens, because it is a very important story for all journalists. Going to our second story now, the ANC policy conference has wrapped up with a number of key areas discussed and also pronouncements made. But there's a criticism that issues were merely postponed until the elective conference. Now that's in December. On the line is political analyst Professor Sipho Siepe. Good afternoon, Professor. Welcome to the show. Were key decisions made at the policy conference, and are they sort of going to be followed through on?
This was a policy conference to make proposals. There was no intention to come up with decisions. What the conference was about was to hear the branches make proposals that will then go back to the branches for further deliberations. So the one should not expect that any decision was going to be made. But what was interesting for me was the nature of engagement, in the sense of what were the issues that were on the table. And I'm saying this because for the last 2 years, and especially in the last year, Jacob Zuma was the point of discussion. But and there's been also marches, protests, but what the delegates decided to do is to say, we're not going to allow external forces, even some internal forces, to decide what we should be talking about. So the discussion shifted away from obsession with President Zuma, but to talk about issues like monopoly capital, to talk about issues of, like land, talk about the South African Reserve Bank, and the many other issues. But what I saw was almost a statement that says we reject those who are going to determine for us what should be a discussion and what is a South African problem.
Speaking of white monopoly capital, I mean, there was a report back that I think 8 out of 10 of the commissions had said we don't endorse the actual thing saying white monopoly capital. Then this was disputed later on. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Gwelman presented that very well. He said in the policy formulation process, what you try to do is to accommodate ideas that they will then go back to the branches. The notion of putting numbers, he found that to be mischievous, because what it tended to do is to give an impression that there are sides, two sides, and those sides are proxies of a leadership succession debate. Whereas what should be happening, it should be what are the proposals that are worthy of consideration or debate. So he explained that aspect. The numbers for him and for the delegates were unimportant, because if you're going to talk about the numbers, anybody can rent a crowd and say this is enjoys more support. But what should be the test is the sustainability and the relevance of an idea. And this is what should be more of a concern, whether the idea that is presented is makes sense. And I found them playing around with the issue of saying whether it's white monopoly capital. But what was interesting for me was also the submission that was more sophisticated by Joel on one aspect. The notion of what is the ANC's attitude towards capital. And I found that to be a shift from locating monopoly capital as necessarily an enemy. He says what the attitude of the ANC has always been is to look at, to have a relationship of both cooperation and contestation. And he went to explain that cooperation, in a sense that you do need a capital to be able to advance some of the interests of transformation. For instance, if you're talking about BE, you're talking about the transformation of economy. But where the contestation comes in is when the monopoly capital or capital itself begins to undermine those interests. And therefore, what you do there, you regulate and you discipline. So the language there was different from simply a blanket location of capital as an enemy. And I thought that was quite a very incisive take. And also a take that is also much more realistic, because in the capital society that we find ourselves in, we always talk about a relationship between business, government, and labor. So effectively sophisticating this notion of not making a capital necessarily an enemy, but also to say there are tendencies within those who control the economy to tend to maximize profit at the expense of other issues. So I thought that for me that was a very interesting sophistication, which for the young people, they should actually listen to it, because it's much more closer to how the ANC engages with capital.
Sure. Just listening to you say that, and just maybe changing tack a little bit, and President Jacob Zuma is saying there should be two deputies. What do you make of this?
Well, what the president was doing was reflecting on his own experience. Since Polokwane, the ANC has been through a trauma that almost cemented factions. It has become more factionalized. And what he was saying is that, can we find a way where there can be a contestation that will not lead to this deepening of factions? Because some people within the ANC, since Polokwane, who are members of the ANC, have spent more time almost like they have a political hangover of that defeat, where they spend most of their time trying to undermine the leadership that ultimately won. So you are saying, given his own experience, he found that proposal that came from the branches, but it came from branches, not from him, that there must be ways in which we can find, we can contest with and disagree without becoming disagreeable. But what is most important is that at the end of any contest, you should not have a situation that has happened in the last 10 years, where those who are defeated continue to fight the battle even 10 years on.
Yeah, in other words, have unity. Political analyst Professor Sipho Siepe, thanks for your time on the Madea Report.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Well, the International Criminal Court is delivering judgment today in the matter of South Africa's failure to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. Al-Bashir was in the country in June 2015 to attend the African Union Summit meeting held in Joburg. The Supreme Court of Appeal has confirmed the High Court's finding that government was obliged to arrest him, as he is wanted by the ICC for crimes against humanity. However, instead of arresting him, al-Bashir was allowed to leave the country. Eyewitness News senior reporter Barry Bapen joins us now. He's covering that story. Good afternoon, Barry. What has been said by the court so far leading up to this?
Good afternoon, Ray. Well, what we know is that we're going to be having a decision at 2 o'clock this afternoon. It's going to be streamed live from The Hague. And the court is going to be essentially deciding two points. Whether, in fact, South Africa contravened or was in contravention of provisions or its obligation, contravened its obligation to, under the Rome Statute, to arrest Omar al-Bashir and hand him over to the court, and whether such contravention should be referred to the United Nations Security Council for further deliberation.
Now, Barry, the ANC is saying at their policy conference that they want to withdraw from the Rome Statute anyway. I know this has gone to the courts. Will this make any difference?
Well, you know, speaking to the Southern African Litigation Centre, they've been watching this closely. They were the party which originally brought this to court when Albashir was in South Africa. And, of course, they made representations to the International Criminal Court when South Africa appeared before it. They seem to think that the court will use, you know, once it finds against the South African government that it did contravene it, it might use this as a mechanism to, you know, rekindle negotiations with South Africa to try and keep it in as a party to the Rome Statute. So, you know, South Africa was probably still going to be, the ICC is going to try and retain South Africa as a party to that Rome Statute.
So what sort of sanction could South Africa face exactly? This would then, as you say, go on to the UN.
I'm not actually sure, Ray. I think it might be, you know, censure as a country that, you know, did not assist the court. We have made an obligation to uphold the Rome Statute, and our courts, South African courts, have further found that we were obliged to arrest Omar al-Bashir and hand him over. So I'm not exactly sure how or what would, you know, punishment, if there is that, for South Africa in this regard.
Barry, to your knowledge, is there an appeals process?
Well, there certainly is. As most courts, there would be recourse in that nature, Ray. If you're not satisfied, there would be a mechanism to challenge the findings.
Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bateman on the line from Pretoria. And just news just in, judgment has been reserved to be delivered in the SANEF court case. It'll be delivered at 12 p.m. tomorrow. Coming up shortly, chatting to Mkhatsi Gallons, the head of SANEF.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
20 minutes past 12 o'clock, rain for Stephen this afternoon, and journalists have been called on to wear black or black armbands today in solidarity with the South African National Editors Forum. It's been turning to the courts to stop the Black First, Land First movement from harassing or protesting at the homes of journalists. SANEF is arguing for an urgent court interdict. The BLF has released a list of journalists it's targeting. Now, these reporters have been concentrating on state capture. And you would have seen what happened at the Business Day's Peter Bruce's house. That was last week. A whole lot of people pitching up at his house and protesting. And this is dangerous stuff. On the line is SA National Editors Forum Chairperson Mkhatsi Gallons. Good afternoon, Mkhatsi. Welcome to the Midday Report. This has been a very difficult time, hasn't it, for journalists?
It truly has been a difficult time, Stephen, because, you know, we've been trying to show that this has been a very orchestrated campaign against journalists. And while we brought this matter before court, we know that in the past few months, there has been quite a calculated campaign in an attempt to threaten and silence journalists. I mean, we go back to the time where fake accounts of editors were created to attack, for example, Praveen Gordon. We talk to a time when our journalists out covering protests have been attacked. And, you know, this is just the latest in that orchestrated campaign to try and silence journalists. And, you know, it was important, very important for us that we actually do start taking action, because we are here to protect the rule, to uphold the rule of law. And we are here also to defend the Constitution. And also, it is not just about journalists. It is about the South African democracy, because media freedom is quite key in that Constitution.
Now, judgment has been reserved.
Judgment has been reserved, but I think that we can celebrate round one, because what the judge basically ruled is that the matter is urgent. He also said that the standing of SANEF in this case, he affirmed it. So that is round one. We have won it. But of course, they then had to debate the merits of the case, and judgment has been reserved in that regard. But the important thing was that, you know, it was important to demonstrate to the courts that there is criminality in these protests by the BLF. They're just not ordinary. Going to people's houses, threatening them, and also assaulting them, those are all criminal offenses. And journalists also must be protected by the law.
Now, speaking of assault, a case of assault also being opened regarding journalist Karima Brown.
Yes, you know, we have encouraged, it's not, you know, and also it's not just about this particular incident. We have been talking to a lot of our journalists who have been attacked in the past as well to say they must go to the police and open cases. I think what is important now is that we need to be following up with police. We need to see police actually doing their job, because it is important that crimes against journalists are not just left at cases and being investigated. We need to see those responsible prosecuted. We have had incidences like we saw in Collini where journalists were assaulted in front of TV cameras. We need to hear police saying that this is the latest and those that are implicated are brought to the courts and are actually arrested.
Now, journalists are being provided protection.
You know, a lot of the media houses have looked at the security of their journalists and also where it's necessary they have provided that security. But obviously what we are saying is that we need this decision from the courts so that, you know, our journalists don't live in prison or don't live in fear, because the Constitution says that journalists must be able to do their job without fear or prejudice. We don't want our journalists to be living in fear. But what has also been encouraging, Stephen, is that, you know, the affected journalists and the industry as a whole, you know, is not derailed by this. We take our responsibility very seriously. We do understand that when we do not get things right, we should be criticized, but it is important that criticism happens in the opinion pages, inside our newspapers, on our radio stations. You cannot contest ideas with violence, and that is the important part of this case for us.
And the BLF refusing to back down?
Well, the BLF basically, you know, in court there were different versions of their case, but of course the judge will be the one to decide. At some point they were disowning some of their Twitter accounts, saying that they could have been hacked. But obviously what we are saying is that we need them to say that they will not threaten journalists, they will not continue going to journalists' houses, they will not follow them to their places of worship as they have threatened.
But Clancy, it seems that we're living in a time similar to apartheid. In the bad old days, if a journalist was questioned, you were targeted. It's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
It is quite a sinful thing. And you would think that 23 years into our democracy, we actually do stand strong. We stand strong to defend our constitution. We stand strong to defend the media. And also people to realize this is not just about journalists. It is about all of us as South Africans, our democracy being under threat.
SA National Editors Forum Chairperson Mhlathi Gallons on the line from the Joburg High Court. The Pharmaceutical Society of South Africa has warned against selling flu cocktails without proper interaction or with patients. Just to explain this a little bit, many people often buy these cocktails as they don't have to see a doctor. They're looking for a strong but speedy remedy. They want to go around the doctor, and the association has got a problem with this. On the line is Pharmaceutical Association of SA Head of Public Affairs, Lorraine Osman. Good afternoon, Lorraine. Welcome to the show. Are these cocktails dangerous?
Hello, Ray. You know, they might reach a certain patients, but not to others. But I think that, you know, I also read the newspaper report this morning, and I realized that there was a fundamental problem there. And the fundamental problem is that the Pharmaceutical Society has no authority to tell the larger chains or the smaller pharmacists what they must do. This actually dates back a long time ago. The Pharmacy Council, who regulate pharmacy, actually have been having a concerted effort to do away, or to get pharmacies to do away with pre-packing. So it's got nothing to do with the cold and flu issue. It's got to do with the pre-packing.
Okay.
And in the article, Dr. Joey Hirst from the Medicines Control Council is quoted as saying, well, there are actually stability reasons for it, and that is the reason why the Pharmacy Council is not happy about people pre-packing. There is nothing wrong with actually individualizing medicines that are given to a patient, and we actually expect our pharmacists to do that.
But surely then, if you walk into a pharmacy and you've got the flu and you're feeling pretty miserable, you can describe your symptoms. You can say, well, I'm not allergic to penicillin or whatever else. And the pharmacist can say, right, try this.
Exactly. I think where these flu cocktails came in is that a lot of people did not want to buy a full pack. And just think about the kind of things that they put into the flu cocktails. I know, for example, that they'll put an antihistamine, they'll put a painkiller, it may be paracetamol, they might put in an anti-inflammatory like ibuprofen, And when you look at what is in there, and you think of, well, do I have to buy 3 different packs of medicine? And that's when affordability comes into it for a lot of patients. So what they are happy about, or what I think they are feeling concerned about at the moment, is will I be able to go into the pharmacy and ask them just for a few medicines that I can take for this dose of the flu?
And they are effective, aren't they? I mean, once you take these cocktails, they kind of sort you out.
Well, you know, it's each product that is used in them has a different use. And yes, you are actually trying to deal with all the symptoms of colds and flu. And, you know, in one way, the fact that the person who is suffering goes to the pharmacy first rather than to the doctor is actually a very good thing, because as a country we are looking at antibiotic usage, and it has been accepted by all the professional regulatory bodies and the voluntary associations that we have to be terribly careful with antibiotics, and we mustn't just go to the doctor and say, we've got flu, I need an antibiotic, because that is what has been causing a lot of the problems that we have with antibiotics being, or rather organisms being resistant to the antibiotics. Mm. So yes,
sounds like
penicillin would not be given to a patient in a pharmacy.
Sounds like we're on the same page. Pharmaceutical Association of SA Head of Public Affairs, Lorraine Osman, on the line from Pretoria.
The Midday Report. Business.
And this EWN Business is brought to you by FNB. It's more than just business to you. That's why they help. Well, Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Kuban Naidoo has defended inflation targeting, saying it has its flaws, but it's the least bad option for this country, as monetary policy should be used to create price stability. Deputy Finance Minister Sifiso Buthelezi said last week there was a need to debate whether the central bank's inflation targeting range of 3-6% was still relevant. The Public Protector also said this, but Naidoo says inflation targeting is the best solution in these harsh economic times. Looking at the SA Chamber of Commerce and Industry, business confidence is up at the moment, a little bit slightly. They say the better rand has contributed towards this. And then the new development bank set up by the BRICS Group of Emerging Economies is looking to raise money by issuing dollar-denominated bonds later this year. The agency's president, KV Kamath, says he expects progress on securing an investment rating by an international agency this year, enabling the bank to tap global markets for dollar funding. They want to go big with this. Speaking of the markets, the dollar's resurgence has stalled after the U.S. Federal Reserve's policy minutes failed to provide a clear picture of future interest rate increases. U.S. Federal Reserve policymakers are increasingly split on the outlook for inflation and how it may affect the future pace of interest rate rises. However, the dollar has seen continued strength against emerging market currencies such as the rand and Turkey's lira. And to make matters worse for our local currency, it's lost major ground after the ANC's policy conference called for a relook at the Reserve Bank's ownership. The party said the bank should be independent, though, but that ownership needs to be discussed, and we'll be discussing that shortly. Looking at the markets, the All Share was up slightly, 0.24% at 52,610 points a short while ago. Most of the board was up. The rand is now around 13.45 to the dollar, 17.21 to the pound, 15.28 to the euro. Gold, $1,224.13. And Brent crude oil, $48.41. More business news with Bruce on The Money Show this evening. So looking at some of your SMSs. One says, rubbish. When did Zuma realize that there's a need for two deputy presidents? This is a man who wants at all costs to remain in power, regardless of whether his faction carried the day or not at the elective conference in December. And that's from Chiku in Four Ways. And then just some of your SMSs. A lot of people are not very happy with Professor Sipho Seipe and not agreeing with what he had to say down the line of the two deputy presidents. And then Sammy Romodike, he says, I agree with the proposal to increase social grants from the ages of 18 to 21, provided beneficiaries are studying full-time at tertiary level. Keep your SMSs coming on 31702 or 31567 or tweet on @RayWhiteSA.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
The Rand has lost major ground after it was stated at the ANC's policy conference that the governing party had been discussing nationalisation of the Reserve Bank. At one stage, the Rand lost around 40 cents to the dollar. Now, the ANC has stated that it wants to keep the independence of the bank, but is looking at changing ownership. On the line is Nedbank economist Isaac Machego. Good afternoon, Isaac. Welcome to the show. Would nationalisation change independence of the Reserve Bank? Or would it just operate in the very same way? What do you think?
Ray, I don't believe that getting rid of the minority shareholders of the Reserve Bank would actually change the mandate of the Reserve Bank. You must remember that the mandate of the Reserve Bank is in the Constitution, and you remember that recently we got it from the PP that, you know, that mandate should be amended. But it was quite encouraging yesterday that Enoch Godongwana, who is the chair of the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee, clarified that this proposed change will not affect the constituted mandate of the South African Reserve Bank.
But this did, though, affect the Rand, didn't it?
Yes, we did see the Rand, you know, losing about 20 cents yesterday. Markets are quite thin at the moment, very volatile, so the vulnerable currencies fell. I mean, even yesterday, we saw a significant drop in the Turkish lira. So it was not only the Rand which came under pressure yesterday, but of course, I do acknowledge that this story did contribute to the Rand's weakness.
Now, Isaac, there's also been calls for the bank to do away with inflation targeting. Is this a good idea?
I don't believe so, because, you know, I maintain that every single central bank across the globe is an inflation targeter, either implicitly or explicitly. Now, in South Africa, we've got an explicit inflation target, which is between 3 and 6%, and macroeconomic stability, which incorporates stable inflation, is one of the key conditions necessary for economic growth and sustainable economic growth for that matter.
So in other words, if inflation is just allowed to run, say it does, this could be a problem for maybe interest rates and other things as well?
We've seen that through economic history, Ray. There is no single economy across the globe which has achieved sustainable growth in a very unstable environment. High inflation is not good for growth, particularly for emerging economies, and we must maintain the policies that we have right now.
And hopefully there's going to be broad-based consultation on what happens with the Reserve Bank when it comes to ownership, when it comes to inflation targeting.
Absolutely, Ray. We are hoping for that, and I intend to participate fully, at least when it comes to the mandate of the Reserve Bank.
And when it comes down to the Rand and the dollar, what are we seeing today?
Well, at the moment, it's a bit steady. I mean, yesterday it ended around 13.40. This morning we are at 13.45. So there's still some weakness, but this could do a lot with international factors, mainly the minutes of the Fed meeting, which came out last night.
Nedbank economist Isaac Machego, thanks for joining us on the Midday Report.
It's a pleasure, eh?
It's coming up to 12:45, and there's been anger and outrage after seven people died in a fire at a hijacked building in the Joburg CBD. The building contained a number of shacks inside. Yep, you heard right, a number of shacks inside the building. And questions have been raised once again about people living in such conditions. A man jumped several floors to escape the flames. He died at the scene. On the line is City of Joburg media specialist Leander Mfeka. Hi, Leander. Welcome to the show. A number of fires over the past year in hijacked buildings. What's been done to clean up the city?
Hi, and good afternoon to your listeners. So the city has for some time now been engaged in an attempt to regain or reclaim hijacked buildings throughout the city, which we saw yesterday, is a problem, and particularly in the instances where people live in such conditions that are unsafe and unhealthy. What the city is currently engaged in doing is we're engaged in activities to conduct raids at various buildings throughout the city. We just conducted some this past weekend, both in an effort to identify people who are living there so that we can connect them to the right kinds of services which may be of assistance to them, but also to identify the slumlords who would allow people to live in such deplorable conditions. Over and above that, the city has put aside $219 million to start identifying city-owned property which can be converted into low-cost housing for groups of people such as the ones that found themselves in yesterday's situation.
These sound like fantastic plans, but can they be implemented immediately?
The problem with hijacked buildings in the city is a long-standing one, spanning even beyond 15 years. And civil administrations, it's going to be quite difficult to simply go, well, we can resolve it by tomorrow. Just to put it into context, the city's housing backlog, for example, has about 300,000 people on it, and with the city only having enough capacity to build about 3,000 households in any given year. So that gives it the kind of scope of the problem we face. After yesterday's aftermath, it became incredibly difficult to find a place to temporarily house the affected people yesterday. In fact, we're in discussions with the Department of Human Settlements now to see if we can find a solution to the problem. So it's an incredibly difficult and complex one that, unfortunately, we can't wave a magic wand and have it resolved.
Now, there's also been human rights opposition, lawyers going and saying, look, we don't agree with this. We're going to fight you. Is there no chance of maybe finding common ground between yourselves and these lawyers and the people affected to say, look, it's very obvious there's a massive problem here. How can we sort it out?
As I said, we're always open to those kinds of dialogues and finding solutions to the problems. What we can't agree to, however, is simply going, well, we must provide services in buildings with those kinds of conditions, particularly where the buildings aren't where us providing services in those buildings would further prolong people living in that kind of environment. And as a city, as far as we're concerned, we simply can't justify that. But we remain open to looking at other ways where we can address the problem and actually enhance people's quality of life rather than keep them in those kinds of circumstances.
There have been accusations specifically against the mayor that this is very xenophobic, that the city is not friendly to foreigners. What do you make of that?
Largely, those accusations are unfounded. The issue of hijacked buildings doesn't know or doesn't discriminate between nationalities and where people live. You're as likely to find people, undocumented persons, or people from other countries as you are too likely to find South Africans. So this is not a question. This is not a question of nationality or targeting particular people from particular nationalities. This is about addressing a much bigger human issue that is about ensuring that the residents of the city live a quality of life that they deserve.
Now, the illegal residents, I'll say illegal residents because they are staying there legally, they went back inside the building after the fire was put out. They say they got nowhere else to go. Is that the case?
Unfortunately, so I can't necessarily speak to them going back into the building. Our discussion with the owner of the building after we managed to trace them yesterday was that the building would be sealed. And that was the arrangement between the city SAPS and the owner. And I am aware, however, that the city couldn't necessarily find accommodation for all of the 300 or so people that were affected yesterday. What the city did provide is, together with SASA, we provided food for the affected persons. We provided blankets, particularly for children. There were about 21 children that we identified as part of the group coming out of that building yesterday. What the Department of Disaster Management has managed to do today is that they've managed to find tents which can be used as temporary accommodation for the affected people, and we're still in discussions with the Department of Human Settlements to see if we can identify land where we can temporarily accommodate these people while we seek a more permanent solution. But given the space constraints within the city and the surrounds, that's proving to be a very difficult exercise. But nonetheless, we remain committed to trying to resolve it.
Leander, do we know who owns these buildings?
By and large, it's often quite difficult to determine who are the owners of the buildings at any given time. You'll find a number of people claiming to be the owners, but it's actually proves quite often to be quite difficult to find the original title deed holder. In this particular situation, we're eventually able to trace the person in question, but it's often quite difficult, and that's part of why we do the raids. The reason why the city and together with SAPS, the Department of Home Affairs, and JMPD goes and conducts these raids to specifically try and identify who are the people benefiting from these people living under these conditions and trying to work our way backwards from there.
And just a final question, national government, what has been their buy-in into this?
So certainly it was quite heartening to see comments from the Minister of Police late yesterday who continues to pledge his support in assisting the city address the problem that we face with respect to hijacked buildings. The Department of Human Settlements has also come on board given yesterday's unfortunate event, and we're all working together in a coordinated fashion to try and find a solution.
Leander Mveka, spokesperson for the City of Johannesburg. Thanks for your time on the Midday Report.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Asking the question this afternoon, the ANC suggesting that the social grants age should be increased to 21 from 18. And I asked the question, is this a good idea? I know a lot of people are struggling, a lot of child-headed households, so I'd like to hear from you. SMS 31702 or 31567. We will be chatting about it shortly. A few people saying it is a good idea. One person says, I agree with the proposal to increase the social grants age to 21, provided people get on with their studies. Another one says, oh, this is Aisha Nakhdi, I beg your pardon. Aisha Nakhdi, she says, Atre-wide essay, ANC trying to buy votes by increasing age after grants crisis. Voters know that they won't lose grants if they don't vote for the ANC. Is it a political thing? I'm not sure if it is. And then one or two other SMSs. One says the formation of the Reserve Bank is the single biggest crime against humanity. And I swear that's no exaggeration. They've used this to gain world domination. Gain world domination? Have they really? And then another one says, hi Ray, Zuma always speaks of radical economic transformation. He speaks the truth when talking to the media. What he does not say, though, is he is trying to radically transform his own pockets. And that's Luke in Roodepoort.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Well, let's have a look at that social grant story now. The ANC says it wants the government to extend the limits for social grants from 18 to 21. The decision was taken by the Social Transformation Committee at the party's National Policy Conference. About 17 million people already rely on social grants. On the line is the MD at Equality Works, Marlene Potgieter. Hi, Marlene. Welcome to the show. Is this a good idea or not?
Good morning. Well, good afternoon, rather. I think that it's a stopgap. It seems to me like it's a plug in the dike. Obviously, it's great for poverty alleviation for that group of people that's so affected. But it seems to me that it should be addressed in a completely different way, that one should address the reason for the unemployment in the first place and look at job growth, growing the small, micro, and medium enterprises, looking at bridging programs for people who come out of school and universities and how to enter the workplace, trying to stimulate or trying to address the idea that you don't always have to have a university degree to succeed in life, to kind of look at other programs that generate income or that allow you, that qualify you in order to generate income rather than just having a university degree. So, yes, I suppose as an immediate stopgap, it's not a bad idea, but as a long-term initiative, I don't think that it'll work.
Marlene, is there maybe not also a problem with child-headed households? In other words, people need to have that finance just to get ahead a little bit.
Sure, that probably is a massive big problem. And as I said, it alleviates the immediate problem for those people who are so desperately looking for employment. And I personally get job applications, so many daily, and it's heartbreaking because people, you know, are not qualified to enter the workplace. So it is an immediate alleviation, I think. But as a policy decision, I don't think it's a good idea.
Marlene, why do you think this is happening? Like you say, people just don't have the adequate qualifications. They have the enthusiasm, but they just can't get through the door. Is it a case that governments, or maybe let's not blame government, even private sector, is not offering those educational experiences?
Sure. It's difficult to see, to immediately say where the fault lies. I do think that on a macro level, the job creation should be addressed more aggressively, and the reasons for the unemployment. I do think that the private sector is doing quite a lot from a skills development perspective. In my own personal experience, and this is obviously anecdotal, so many organizations offer internships and provide skills gaps for people. Well, it's a very big topic for discussion, and probably what you're highlighting is that there should be some initiative to identify the problem first before we implement these stopgap measures.
The ANC's policy conference has just concluded. What did you make of job creation and the ANC's idea of a policy for job creation?
Do you know, Ray, I honestly can't answer that. I didn't follow it that closely. So I can't answer that.
No, that's fair enough. But I think the bottom line is create jobs, 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 less on the state.
Yes.
Yeah, easy as that. Marlene Porchetta, MD at Equality Works. Thanks for your time on the Midday Report. Love to chat to you throughout the afternoon. You can tweet me on @RayWhiteSA, but it is 1 o'clock.